May it please the Court, Michael Cox appearing on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Hope Glenn as the personal representative of the estate of Lucas Glenn. And if I may, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor. We are here today to ask you to reverse the judgment of the District Court that we feel denied the Glenn family their right to a jury trial of their claims. As this Court knows, we have two claims, a Section 1983 claim and a state law negligence claim. We believe we could prove to a jury that the police officers in this case acted unreasonably in causing the death of the Glenn's son, Lucas, and that we should have the right to do that, to prove that to a jury.
Could I just ask you, in organizing your argument, under the 1983 claim, could you distinguish this case from D'Oral, which also used beanbags, and see whether or not you think this case is favorable to you on clearly established law or can be distinguished? I assume you'll take a position on that, and how. But then the other question I have then goes to Oregon law, which I'm trying to understand whether Oregon law, assuming, for example, that it was clear under D'Oral that for federal purposes, Fourth Amendment purposes, let me reframe it. If under D'Oral we were to decide that that wasn't clear enough to establish 1983 liability, or if it was, either way, does Oregon law have a different standard? In other words, does it apply to police officer conduct, a normal tort, reasonable man standard of liability that would, no matter how the federal law would treat this use of a beanbag under these circumstances, that Oregon could pick up the negligence or the tort aspect that Judge Mossman referred to in the course of his opinion?
I'll start with your second question. I think I understand what you're asking, Judge. Yeah. And I'll start with your second question. I mean, going back to the first question, I'll come back to it. We do believe D'Oral applies. We do believe it's clear that it applies to the facts and circumstances of this case. But going to your second question, I don't think there's any case law that has said that police officers are subjected to a different standard than the normal reasonableness standard that we apply to Oregon tort law in negligence cases.
But would that be the reasonable man be the perspective of a reasonable police officer, or would it be the perspective of, you know, one of the bystanders then?
No, I think that's an interesting question, and it's not something we really discussed in the briefs.
And I know, and that's why I find it strange that Oregon law would have an exemption under some circumstances, at least from criminal liability, for police officers who are exercising all of the judgments one has to carry out in these split-second, highly charged circumstances. I haven't been able to find any cases helpful on this under Oregon law, so that's why I'm asking.
Right.
That somehow the police officers aren't put in the circumstances that they have to confront, at least when judging the reasonableness of their behavior. That's something modified from a straight-up normal negligence standard.
Right, and I do think if you look at the Sterling versus Albany case, which is the one case we have been able to get you, mm-hmm. that they did apply basically a straight-up reasonableness standard, it appears in that case. They didn't allow for special defenses of good faith or probable cause, which the police officers argued for in that case. And so we don't believe, you know, if you come to this defense of justification that Judge Mossman applied in this case, we don't believe a criminal defense, especially when the terms of that criminal defense as it's defined, do not state that it's a bar to civil liability, that that anywhere applies to barring civil liability. But instead, you apply the Oregon standard of the reasonableness standard that we have here in this state. And I think that, you know, and you see it in some of the federal cases where they always talk and refer back to, hey, state law, tort law is a lesser standard than we have under Section 1983. Even though we're both talking about reasonableness, objectively reasonable over here in Section 93, state law reasonableness, we know that this standard of Section 1983 is a much higher standard because of all the added verbiage the Supreme Court has created over the years and the circuits have created over the years, that there's a lot of other things you have to look at in analyzing a Section 1983 claim that you don't necessarily have to look at in analyzing an Oregon state law negligence claim. So we believe it's pretty clear that the trial court misapplied the standards in dismissing the Oregon state law negligence claim, because it did so just basically on two things. One, well, since we dismissed the 1983 claim, we're dismissing the state law claim. And number two, we're going to apply this justification defense that nowhere's ever been applied as a defense to a state law negligence claim, and which really is being used by the court, when you read it, to get rid of all the pre-shooting negligent conduct. That's what the court wiped away with that. And we don't believe you can do that under Oregon state law. And I think Sterling versus Albany, they analyze all the facts, all the pre-shooting conduct. I would go back now to I think this court is probably more interested in the Section 1983 claim, being the federal claim, and go back to Dioral and tell you why we think it applies and why we think the court erred in not applying it but finding a distinction to move away from it. The district court moved away from it basically on one argument, armed versus unarmed, and they used that to suggest that Lucas Glenn somehow was a greater threat to the officers and the others in the area than Mr. Dioral was in his case. I don't believe you can do that, and in fact, I think that the facts and circumstances of the Lucas Glenn case versus the facts and circumstances of the Dioral case shows that Lucas Glenn is no greater threat than Mr. Dioral is to the others or the officers in his case. Now, Mr. Dioral doesn't have a weapon in his hand at the time. He has a can or a bottle, but he's had weapons all over the property that are near him, hatchet, a crossbow, a rail with protruding nails that he's repeatedly picked up and put down, repeatedly picked up and put down.
Well, he walked away from them.
In the last instance, he's walking away from the crossbow toward the officer.
They weren't accessible.
I don't think that was part of the case. I don't think they ever determined that they were no longer accessible to him, but that he didn't have them at that moment. I think that you could read from the case that all those weapons are still there. They're just laying on the ground somewhere on his property.
Well, your expert, however, went through, and his analysis was that there were, you know, a lot of hasty judgments made here, but he relied heavily on the fact that they had available a lesser alternative, which was the taser. Now, that's interesting because we have had en banc cases recently argued to us where the argument is that would essentially put taser on the same level or pretty close to a beanbag. If the taser, and we got fairly well educated on the foibles of tasers as to how they can be defective or, you know, they aren't as effective. And what's troubling me in this case is your expert says, well, they could have gone to a taser. You have a guy with a knife. He's armed. That's what Judge Mossman kept focusing on. That knife is not a small knife. Yes, he's pressing it against his neck, and he's inflicting self-damage. But he's armed, and he's got he's obviously being belligerent and non-cooperative. So your expert says what they should have done was try to calm him down, and they had a less lethal option. If the taser isn't a less lethal option, any better than the beanbag, what would they have done then to stabilize it?
Well, we had pointed out there's actually even a better option than a taser. The taser is our fallback argument. Our initial argument is using typical crisis intervention techniques: questioning, persuasion, delay, time. Those are weapons you use that involve intellect.
Their argument is he wasn't responding to anything. He was just totally agitated and out of control, and he was with a, he had a weapon in his hand.
Right, and we have to look at the record and draw the inferences as best we can for the plaintiff here, and in doing so, we can see all they did is create chaos in the 3 minutes and 44 seconds that transpire between when the first officer arrives and the lethal fire is shot. They did not try questioning or persuasion. They did not try that alternative. All they did was scream and create chaos, and they admitted themselves that Lucas Glenn may not have been able to hear or understand what they were saying amidst all this screaming and yelling.
Okay, so who was doing all the screaming and yelling? Just the two officers?
No, then Lucas Glenn was doing some screaming and yelling as well. Parents were trying to talk him out of to put the knife down, as well as his friend.
So what is the evidence that somebody with a calm voice would have suddenly resolved and de-escalated the situation?
We have it both in our expert report that said that those techniques are the appropriate techniques to use.
He said that, so, well, I mean, the manual itself talks about that, and there was the supervisor who advised them to breathe, you know, do all that.
Right.
But the problem is, at least under the law, not the negligence law, but the Fourth Amendment law, is from the perspective of the officers. We've been admonished time after time is that it's the officer's perspective, and Judge Mossman went through in a very careful way saying, look, these officers were confronted with somebody out of control. He admitted that they were, I mean, he acknowledged these officers were not good at the way they set it up, but what they were trying to do was to take down somebody in a non-lethal use of a weapon with the beanbag. That's what they did. They tried to knock him down. They could have gone to the talk, or they could have done something which even your own expert said a taser would have immobilized him theoretically.
Well,
you know, how does, you know, it's a difficult situation to be assessing after the fact.
Right. Well, I think that you got to look at all the...
Grant, it's tragic.
I understand what you're saying, but we think Judge Mossman actually did not consider all the facts and circumstances, and he left out some very critical ones, in part being that Lucas Glenn's demeanor changes throughout this confrontation, that the statements he's making is, you kill me or I kill me, and yelling at the officers, to his final statement, which is, why are you yelling at me? Which is a change in demeanor and shows that there is some progress being made here, and a plea to come and have a negotiation with him or talk to them. There is no reason to start shooting him with a beanbag gun at this moment in time. He is showing a lot of compliance by remaining in the same spot. He's not posing a danger to anyone else at this point because he's only holding the knife to his own neck. He's not making any verbal threats to anyone else. He's not brandishing a weapon toward anyone else as Dioral did. And Dioral made verbal threats to other people as well. He has no criminal history like Dioral had. He's actually showing less of a threat than Dioral did at the moment in time they pulled the trigger on this beanbag gun. The unanswerable question we feel for the other side and for Judge Mossman is, why at this particular moment in time did this beanbag gun have to be deployed on him when we know from Dioral you have to have a very strong governmental interest to do so? Now, the Judge Mossman tried to, knowing that there was some problems, I believe, with that he posed a threat of danger to others or the officers. He couldn't get to anyone else or the officers. They had two guns from 6 to 12 feet away aimed at him. He has no chance.
Is it possible they might be entitled to qualified immunity on the beanbag shooting, but not on the on the shooting of the guns?
That's an interesting question I haven't thought about. I believe that they are not entitled to qualified immunity on the beanbag itself.
Right.
And then the question becomes, once they deploy the beanbag and that the particular character of the movement they see, and we can go into this recent Hayes case that I provided the site to the court recently, the movement isn't a threatening movement, but is a movement to avoid the beanbags where he's turning his back, yeah, and he's kind of sliding away, that could somehow be interpreted as an attack. I think there's a good argument that they're not entitled to qualified immunity there either. I have my reserve.
Counsel, if I can ask you a quick question.
Yes, Judge.
As I recall, he got shot 8 times. Maybe they fired a dozen rounds or so. How many of those shots that struck him hit him in the back?
We believe there's arguably one that wasn't the backside but was more of the side, but at least seven of the eight struck him in the backside, even though I think most people would say when you look at the forensic evidence that all eight struck him in the backside.
Okay, so when they used the definitely lethal force, he wasn't running at them. He was trying to get away at that time, right?
That's correct, Judge, and I think that the jury can infer from the where the shots are located that he's not also running at the parents' door, as Judge Mossman or the officer suggested, but his back is toward them where they're lined up. The shots would not hit him in the back if he's even running toward the parents' door. They would be in the direction where he's trying to escape this onslaught of beanbags in toward the alcove.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
May it please the Court, Bill Blair representing defendants. At the outset, I would like to point out that the facts as outlined in our brief, I cannot take credit for, much as plaintiffs would like me to. They are borrowed wholesale from Judge Mossman's opinion.
Well, you know, if you read Judge Mossman's opinion carefully, he sometimes acts like a trier of fact rather than taking the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party.
He makes
findings in that order of his.
I cannot agree with that, Your Honor.
Well, I know you're not going to agree with that, but I'm just telling you, that's the way I read his order. This was a motion for summary judgment on the issue of qualified immunity, and where there's any dispute of fact that's material to the outcome,
yes,
you take that fact in favor of the non-moving party.
Yes. Agreed. And the reason I say I can't agree with your proposition is that Judge Mossman did so. And you would have to compare the concise statement of material fact that we had presented with the facts found by Judge Mossman.
You're not finding facts.
The facts as outlined by Judge Mossman or as stated by Judge Mossman. I agree. The trial court's job is not to find facts. It is simply to find disputes as to facts.
Just on this last point that Judge Gould raised, for example.
Sure.
Judge Gould pointed out that the forensics evidence would show or raised the question, and counsel answered that the forensic evidence would show that the bullets were entered him through the back.
Yes.
Now, there's a dispute as to whether he was headed towards the house where his parents were or whether he was headed away. Why? Judge Mossman essentially said that he was headed towards the house where his parents were. Why isn't that a genuine tribal issue of fact?
At the time the judgment was made by the two deputies to fire lethal rounds, Lucas Glenn was beginning to run and had taken a step or two toward the front door of the house where his parents were. At that point, they made the decision to pull the trigger. In that split second, Lucas Glenn turned and ran down a concrete walkway toward his grandmother's door.
Now, you're taking the facts in the light most favorable to the officers by giving that characterization.
No, I think everybody agrees that his path was from the corner of the garage toward the front door and then down the walk.
Some news to me.
Well, okay, so given the oral, why do we have any wiggle room on clearly established, since the oral is quite close to the facts of this case?
D'Url, with respect, Your Honor, is in very important respects different than the facts of this case. The court in D'Url found that the failure to give a warning was significant. There were warnings given in this case.
Well, there's dispute as to whether he could possibly have heard them.
Whether he heard them or not, they were given.
Well, they were given. All right, fine.
The police cannot control what the person hears. All they can do is act in accordance with their professional training.
All right.
Warnings were given. In Dioral, the plaintiff was not armed. He had a pop can in his hand, but was in no way using that or threatening that as a weapon. In Dioral, the distance was much greater, and therefore the opportunity for the officer to take some other action much greater. In Dioral, there was no direct...
What was the relative distance?
Pardon me?
They were within 8 feet, is that it?
There is a dispute about the distance, but I would certainly say that at the closest, the plaintiff's argument is 8 feet, and ours would be about 21 feet.
Well, we have to take the plaintiff's, okay.
But that part is really not material in comparing to Dioral.
But as I understand it, you said the distance was in Dioral was much greater, so we would take your facts and say... that they were 21. He was 21 feet away.
Okay. And in Dioral was much greater. I believe the distance was something like 40 feet.
So how does that cut? I'm having trouble.
Distance equals time.
Yeah.
And this is just simple physics.
Yeah.
The speed and the distance at which a threat moves toward a police officer is a significant factor for that officer in determining what actions to take. In Dioral, there were no commands given. The guy's 40 feet away. He's not running. He's just moving toward the officer. And the officer backs up against a tree and fires a beanbag at him at a distance in which that shot caught Dioral in the eye. In this case... the distance was, the use of the beanbag was to maintain a safe distance for the officers while still gaining compliance with this person who was highly agitated, severely emotional, was intoxicated, and was brandishing a knife and not just a pocket knife, but a significant weapon with a gutting hook on the end.
When you say brandishing, he had a knife that was pressed against his own throat.
He had a knife that was pressed against his own throat. He had taken that knife at one time, stabbed it into the garage door, and at another time was
that in front of the officers?
Pardon?
Did he stab it in front of the door in front of the officers?
Did he stab in...
But you said he...
Yes.
Judge Fisher said it was at his neck.
Yes.
And while the officers were there, did he take that knife and go like this to the garage door?
I have to say I believe so, but I cannot...
That's another... Yeah. I don't recall that particular fact.
What you will recall is that there is... that he pointed the knife in different directions as well as holding it at his throat.
Well, you just said he stabbed it into the garage door.
He did.
Okay.
Counsel, I've got a question for you, if I may.
Sure.
And I recognize this is a very difficult case. You know, difficult for the mother, difficult for the police, difficult for Judge Mossman, difficult for counsel on both sides, and difficult for our panel. But still, I come back to a few points that seem fundamental to me. First of all, before the police deployed the beanbag gun, did Lucas ever get a warning? Like, okay, put the weapon down now, or you're going to get shot with the beanbag gun? Because as I read this, it seemed like someone like the cop, the policeman from Tigard, yelled out, beanbag, beanbag, but that he wasn't given a clear warning, you're going to be shot with a beanbag gun if you don't comply. So am I missing something, or did he just get shot with a beanbag gun without a warning?
There is... no dispute that at least some reference to beanbag was made by the Tigard officer. Whether it was simply beanbag, beanbag, or whether it was as described by Tony Morales, who was one of the friends of Lucas Glenn sitting on the ground or lying on the ground some distance away and watching the whole thing, who said that the Tigard officer arrived, said, I have the beanbag, and then said, drop the knife or you'll be shot. The other part to that is that before the Tigard officer arrived with the very visible shotgun, two deputies were pointing their handguns at Lucas Glenn, both of them ordering him to drop the knife, and at least one of them telling him, drop the knife or you will be shot.
Right. No, I understand that, but just getting back to the beanbag again with Judge Pius's question and Judge Fisher's earlier, it is a summary judgment. And so if one witness says that the Tigard officer said, drop the knife or you will be shot with the beanbag gun, that's one bit of evidence. But if someone else more favorable to the parent said, all that was said was beanbag, beanbag, and he might not have understood that, then on a summary judgment, don't you have to take the version most favorable to the deceased?
Two responses to that, Your Honor. First, when a law enforcement officer who's pointing a gun at you says, drop your knife or you will be shot, my suggestion is that is reasonable warning. And if you are later shot, it's probably lucky that you were shot with a beanbag and not with a 40 caliber handgun. But the second part of that answer is the decision as to when to fire and what warning to give was that of the Tigard officer. He is not a defendant in this case. The only defendants are the two Washington County deputies and Washington County itself, along with its sheriff.
So, relating to that, I'll just ask the final question, then try to be silent for Judge Pius's question. But that at the point they fired the lethal shots, if the shots in general hit the deceased in the back, it suggests that he's moving away from the officers, that he's not closing on them. So the idea of a short distance putting them at risk doesn't apply at all, right, if he's running away from them. And the only question is, was he running toward one of his relatives who he might have harmed?
I would restate that question slightly, Your Honor, because we will never know what was in the mind of Lucas Glenn. We will certainly never know whether he made that movement to avoid beanbags. We simply know, and the officer simply knew at the time, this person who has been standing there in an altercation verbally with us is now moved his position and is running toward a place where he is a threat to people in the house. And it was that movement, that motion, that was the trigger of their decision to use lethal force in defense of the people in the house.
He's a high school. Do they know that he's not like a roaming criminal, but he's a high school student who's the son of the people in the house?
They know that he is the son of the people in the house, and they know, at least they are told by dispatch initially, that they are being dispatched to a fight with a knife. They know that he is yelling generally and perhaps intoxicated. His age is certainly that of a young adult. And his...
Over the dispatch, it had the date of birth, right?
I believe that is correct. Whether anybody did the math or not, at least certainly he did not...
Something like
that. Yeah, certainly he didn't look 46 or 13. He was...
Could I ask you a question, if you don't mind? You know, the officer said, had the gun pointed at him and said, put the knife down or we'll shoot. I forget the exact word, something to that effect. Would it have been proper for the officers to have shot him when he didn't put the knife down with the gun?
No.
No. Something would have had to have happened.
Yes, as it did in this case.
And your point is, by his movement after being shot with a beanbag, in your view, was sufficient, even though there's a dispute over where he was moving.
He
wasn't moving towards them, correct?
It is correct he was not moving toward them.
They don't claim that they were trying to defend themselves when they shot him with the gun.
They were not trying to defend themselves when they shot him with the gun. They were trying to defend the people that were in the house. Because they knew that he had already kicked in the door of the house.
Right.
That it couldn't be locked.
And the people in the house were his mom and dad, correct?
Yes. And grandmother in the room that he was running towards at the time he fell. They knew these things, and they knew that there were weapons in the house. While he was outside, he couldn't get to them. And once he gets in the house, he then has the potential for hostages. He then has the potential for doing harm to these people. The decision that they made was that exactly that sort of split-second decision that we should not view with 20/20 hindsight that a police officer is sometimes called to make in the field. It was a split second.
Okay, but I'm going to let you go over a little time because I would like you to address the Oregon law, keeping in mind that, as Judge Mossman pointed out, there was a tremendous amount of inappropriate response before any of this unfolded, because these guys showed up on scene. This whole thing took place in 4.5 minutes. They were screaming and yelling. They got information from their supervisor that they should breathe and take control of the situation that way. Judge Mossman pointed that out and said that that's really something that might be relevant under tort law, but not under federal 1983 law. The argument being made is that under Oregon state law, and I don't find, Sterling is a case I'm familiar with, but aside from the Sterling case, it's not clear to me what Oregon law is vis-a-vis the negligence aspect of this. But if tort law applies, it seems to me that there's a whole lot of activity that even Judge Mossman acknowledged could be relevant to a state claim under Oregon law as to whether these guys were negligent in creating a confrontational situation that escalated and that they wound up overreacting from the get-go and essentially created the situation that then caused them to, A, deploy the beanbag and then turn around within seconds and shoot him to death. So is it or is it not your position that Oregon law is the same as or is broader than 1983 law?
It is certainly different than.
Okay, so why in that case then is Judge Mossman's summary disposition saying it wasn't wrongful because I just found under 1983 law it wasn't wrongful? Why isn't that wrong and needs to go back for analysis under Oregon law?
I'm not sure that that's I understand Judge Mossman's opinion to be more nuanced than that. We've discussed just briefly in our brief the Fazzolari case, which is the Oregon case that does away with the concept of duty, breach, causation, and damages and simply says that absent some specific duty imposed by law, a person is obligated to act reasonably to prevent foreseeable harm. applying that standard under Oregon law, this situation was out of control before the police arrived. That's why they were called in the first place. It was a situation that they had to attempt to bring under control, making tactical decisions on the fly and in split seconds. So what is acting reasonably and what is foreseeable harm become extremely slippery concepts, I think, under Oregon tort law. But the reason behind Judge Mossman's decision on the pendant or the supplemental state claim, I think, is that by having found that the actions of the deputies were constitutionally reasonable, in other words, that they were taken for the purpose of defending others from harm, then the Oregon statutes on justification provide a basis for the affirmative defense, which we pleaded and bear the burden on summary judgment, the affirmative defense of justification. Given that affirmative defense, I urge the court to take a look at the cases cited in page 15 of our brief, State v. Bates, State v. Foster, and Rich v. Cooper, in which the Oregon Supreme Court takes largely the same position that the United States Supreme Court did in Graham v. Connor, saying that the standard of care of a police officer in a highly charged, rapidly evolving situation where he must make split-second decisions is not to be governed by 20/20 hindsight. Pardon me. And deference is to be given to those tactical judgments of the officers.
Counsel, Judge Gould,
I
have a question on your state law claim, if Judge Fisher doesn't mind my proceeding. Assuming that we accept Judge Mossman's position on the 1983 claims, and that both the claim against the officers is out and the Monell claim is out, and that only state law claims remain, then as a matter of federalism, I take it that this Oregon Supreme Court, if it wanted to, could say we take a view of a wrongful death action in Oregon that's different than the way the Supreme Court of the U.S. views federal law, right? The state court would be free to do that, right?
In other contexts, the Oregon Supreme Court has done so several times.
Okay, now if that's true, I thought we also had a precedent, I'm sorry I can't recall the name, something like Acre, that says that if all the federal claims are gone and only state claims remain, that a district court is supposed to give reasons on the record for why the court is going to exercise a supplemental jurisdiction over the state law. And I didn't see here anything in Judge Mossman's opinion that addressed that issue, that gave reasons for handling the state law claims, if I'm right that we have some precedent indicating that should have been done.
Must confess, first, Your Honor, that my understanding of that is limited, and my understanding is that precedent applies at a Rule 12 stage. If federal claims disappear and the court's going to retain jurisdiction of the state claims, there should be some reason on the record why it does so. This is a summary judgment in which all issues are before the court. both federal and state, and a global decision is made. So I frankly would not be sure.
Well, he had discretion. He could have said, I've decided the constitutional claim, and I decline to assert supplemental jurisdiction over the state law claim.
Absolutely.
And I gather it wasn't this case did not start in state court, so he would just decline jurisdiction over supplemental jurisdiction.
Yes.
And then I imagine, would the statute of limitations be told in state court?
I believe it is.
So then they could go file their state law claim in state court and litigate it in state court.
Yes.
Isn't that right?
Yes.
But instead, he chose to rule on the whole package.
He did.
And that's primarily because he thought that having resolved the federal constitutional claim on the merit, he essentially said there's no constitutional violation here. So that takes care of the state law claim.
With respect, Your Honor, again, I think that is a bit simplistic. His basis was saying, having resolved the federal constitutional claim and thereby determined that the conduct of the officers was reasonable.
That takes care of the state law
that
claim.
That takes care of the state law claim. On the justification issue primarily, I think. I can't read Judge Mossman's mind. I wish I could.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just clarify a couple quick issues. He did not stab the garage door when the police officers were there. He held the knife to his own neck there. Never made any threats to the officers with the knife or anything like that on this record. I was going to read to the court the movement that's described by the witnesses. While being struck by beanbag rounds, Luke put his hands down, grabbed his pants, and began to move away from the beanbag fire toward the alcove between the house and garage. Luke was moving in the most obvious line of retreat from the fire. After one or two steps by Luke, defendants Gerba and Metesky fired their guns at Luke. That's what you have in this record in regards to the movement. And in regards to the warning, the record you have before you is beanbag, boom, boom, boom. There, with no opportunity to comply, fired immediately thereafter, with no opportunity to comprehend what that's supposed to mean.
Although he was told, yelled at anyway, that if he didn't comply, he'd be shot.
Earlier in the confrontation, and we have different
wording. Earlier, we're only talking three minutes, 44 seconds.
Yeah, right. Earlier in the confrontation, there was a statement that's admitted in the record and undisputed that drop the knife or we're going to kill you, of that nature, which is different in nature than being told we're using this weapon that's just to create pain compliance to get you to drop the weapon.
Somehow,
it's not
lesser would seem to be included in.
Well, I think for a person who's standing there to hear that I'm going to be shot or if I don't drop the knife is something like, really? Versus, we've got a different weapon we're going to use. If you don't drop it, we really will use this one. That could have a different impact. And that's why in Hayes and in Diorley, they're so adamant about you have to give this warning before you use this type of weapon.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Very difficult case, tragic, and we appreciate the good arguments. All right, we'll stand in adjournment, I guess.